someone appears at the end of a long corridor. They're walking towards a desk and a chair. The man's carrying a folder. He takes a seat, then slides some black and white photographs out of the folder. A group photo of some soldiers is dated 1941 to 43. The photograph he chooses is of men and women walking through a town.
This is interesting photo because you can see that people are turning their faces. People are scared, they don't know where they're going. I mean, they do suspect, I'm pretty sure some of them, this is their final destination, final march.
He selects another picture.
Another photo. This is probably an area where Jews were gathered a few minutes, hours maybe, before execution.
The next picture taken from inside a vehicle.
It's a turning point of the Holocaust, how it will be perpetrated, implemented by Nazis. It all started in Kamenets Podolsky. Mass killings of Jews without any regards to their age, ideology, participation in the Soviet system. Everyone had to be destroyed. And Kamenets Podolsky, I think, is an example of such massacre, first example of such massacre on such scale. I would say that it's ground zero.
The Ukrainian flag.
Ukraine, the second largest country in Europe. A fertile land, rich in resources. Land that, throughout its history, has been invaded, occupied, and fought over by different regional powers, right up to the present day.
A battleground.
And so it was in 1941, when the invasion of Ukraine came from the west, from Nazi Germany. In the following 3 years, Ukraine suffered some of the most horrific acts of genocide perpetrated during the Second World War. Massacres that led to little-known war crimes trials in the Soviet Union, including the Ukrainian cities of Kharkiv and Kyiv, captured on rarely seen Soviet propaganda film.
A witness says, between two rows of policemen, the people were herded forward to the pits where they were shot. How many were shot? Up to 25,000.
This is the story of Ukraine during the Second World War. A chapter in its bloody history that continues to cast a long shadow over the country today, as it is ravaged by another brutal conflict, with accusations of fascism made by both sides, and as evidence of war crimes emerges once again. It is the story of the beginning of the Holocaust, of atrocities that took place on such a scale that details are still being uncovered today.
1 out of 4 Jews who died in the Holocaust resided in what is the territory of Ukraine today. So this really was an important region.
So many have been identified, but obviously not all, and especially those who died in the open-air mass shootings, forcing me to really think about these realities of missing, of the limits of what we can learn. Doesn't mean we should stop digging.
For those who survived, it is a harrowing history that lives on in the memory.
They killed my brother. They buried him alive. He was 7.
Flashes of images of children, soldiers, and maps. Ukraine, Holocaust Ground Zero. Archive film of heavy artillery fire.
Just before midnight, on the 22nd of June 1941, over 3.5 million German and Allied troops attacked the Soviet Union along an 1,800-mile front from its Baltic states in the north to the Black Sea in the south. It was the largest invasion force the world had ever seen. This was Operation Barbarossa.
a German soldier firing a machine gun.
But this was a campaign like no other. Just 2 weeks before the invasion, German forces had been issued with the Commissar Order, demanding the swift execution of suspected political and intellectual elites, often identified as Jews. It was 9 months before the deportation of Jews to Auschwitz concentration camp would get underway. But for Jews in the Soviet Union, not least Ukraine, the Holocaust was about to begin.
Omer Bartov, Brown University.
Well, it was an entirely different kind of military operation from anything that had been done before. The goals were not only to defeat the Red Army, but to take over vast tracts of territory and then either to kill or to enslave the Slavic population there.
Hitler perceived the Soviet Union as a kind of Jewish empire, an empire led by a Jewish elite, and that Bolshevism was by and large a Jewish invention.
Dieter Pohl, University of Klagenfurt.
They were embarking on an imperial campaign. Their goal was to take over the land, what they call the Lebensraum of Eastern Europe, to create a kind of utopia.
Wendy Lauer.
Hitler said that the Crimea was going to be his Riviera. They were going to build these autobahns. You know, they had this notion of a paradise in the East. So it was about race and space.
Lwów, or Lemberg, the third largest city in Poland. Its population is made up of Ukrainians, Poles, Jews, and a not inconsiderable number of Germans.
After the First World War and the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Ukrainian nationalists had hoped that the city of Lviv, or Lwów in Polish, would be part of a new and independent Ukraine. But there was to be no such state, and Western Ukraine, as it is today, became part of Poland.
Omer Bartov.
This area, which is ruled by Poland between World War I and World War II, the Poles tried to repress Ukrainian nationalism. As a result of that, a Ukrainian underground is created, which tends toward fascism and terrorism. It's called the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the OUN, and it is this organization that speaks constantly about ridding Ukraine of the Jews.
But nationalists' hopes for an independent Ukraine suffered a further setback in August 1939, when Germany and the Soviet Union made an agreement, the so-called Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, to carve up Poland between them. Just days later, Hitler invaded Poland from the west, then Stalin invaded it from the east. And this land, including Lviv, fell under Soviet control. But almost 2 years later, with the launch of Operation Barbarossa and the retreat of Stalin's Red Army, many Ukrainian nationalists saw the Germans as their liberators, freeing them from the despised Soviet regime. Many believed that Ukrainian independence would soon follow.
Right after the Germans entered Lviv, the OUN proclaimed the independent state of Ukraine. But the original declaration includes this reference to Hitler. So we declare independence of the Ukrainian state within Hitler's Europe.
People applauding near a swastika flag.
But for Hitler, it was clear that the Ukrainians are only a tool for him. There won't be any independence under him. They can collaborate with the Germans, but that's it.
Ukraine, Holocaust Ground Zero.
Shortly before the German occupation of Lviv, the Soviet secret police, the NKVD, staged their own massacre in the city, killing almost 3,000 political prisoners, many of them Ukrainian nationalists. With the discovery of these bodies, and the arrival of the German forces, further violence was about to be unleashed.
The first important key event was opening prisons to the public, showing the crimes, Soviet crimes, to the public.
The Germans set up a Ukrainian militia, and they ordered them to clean more or less the prisons, to take away the corpses. And the militia now grabbed Jewish men and forced them to do this dirty work for them. And then what started is beating them up.
Someone being manhandled along the street, then another suffering blows from bystanders.
This spread over the city, and especially Jewish men, but also Jewish women, were taken out from their flats and put in the streets, beaten up.
A naked woman trying to cover herself in the street. A woman in her underwear screaming with blood on her chin.
There's not only the Ukrainian police and Germans present, but there are also bystanders, women, teenagers, somewhat participating in the beatings and humiliations.
Natalia Lazar, United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. More images of public violence.
It was known to many people. Many people heard. Many people seen it. And it was a public crime.
Men trying to run from being beaten. One of them falls and lies motionless. A relentless beating of someone who's already on the ground. Anna Medvedovska, Ukrainian Institute for Holocaust Studies.
Jewish people were depicted as enemies of Ukrainians. In cartoons, Jewish individual was identified as a Bolshevik, distorted, unnaturally exaggerated facial features. And this image got distributed through leaflets, posters, newspapers. There was practically not a single issue of occupational press which did not contain any anti-Semitic material.
A cartoon of a German soldier about to hit a cowering armed man in a hat with a red star on it.
As the Nazis distributed anti-Semitic propaganda, they also began their own campaign of killing Jews in Lviv. For 9-year-old Janine Weber, a normal childhood was about to come to an end.
I remember hearing on our staircase the Nazis, what we call the Gestapo, the German police, armed police. And my father came running in and he said, "The Germans are after me." And my mother locked the door, and my father jumped from our second floor balcony onto the first floor balcony, and he hid underneath. This is the house where I lived, and this is the balcony from which my father jumped. After a couple of hours, my father came back. He had broken his leg, and very soon we were told to leave our flat. And they gave us a little room in a small house because they were getting ready the ghetto. After about a week, my parents dug a hole under the wardrobe, which was in our room. And when we heard the Gestapo coming, my mother, my brother and I, we hid in that hole under the wardrobe. But there was no room for my father and my grandmother. And they hid in the loft of that little house. The Gestapo found them. I asked my mother, "What happened to my father?" And my mother said, "They shot him, and they shot my grandmother, and my uncle, and Nina's brother, who was about 12.
A photo of Janine's smartly dressed father, then an image of men with their arms raised.
By the end of July 1941, an estimated 7,000 Jews had been killed in Lviv, victims of the pogroms and of mass shootings carried out by German death squads, the Einsatzgruppen. Now, as the German army continued to advance east across Ukraine, it was followed by these units, commanded by dedicated Nazis, such as Friedrich Jeckeln, Otto Ollendorf, and Paul Blobel. Just weeks before the launch of Operation Barbarossa, the Einsatzgruppen leaders had been summoned to this castle in Pretzsch, a small town 100 miles south of Berlin. Here they prepared for their task, to kill all perceived enemies of the Reich in the Soviet Union, including Jewish men of military age.
The castle in the distance.
The initial killing is done by Einsatzgruppen, which are the killing squads of the SS and the police. They altogether number about 3,000 men.
Jeckeln was one of them. He was a professional military man during World War I. This is a man, you know, brainwashed to the core, you know, with anti-Semitic ideology. One of the phrases attributed to him, apparently he said something at the massacre site, that Jews have to be killed so that we Germans would live.
Ominously, within weeks of the invasion of Ukraine and other parts of the Soviet Union, the orders for the killing squads were already under review.
For the first 5 weeks, the Einsatzgruppen kill almost exclusively male Jews of military service age.
What happened now was that they killed the men. So we have lots of people where the father, the husband was killed, and we have to feed them now. And there was this, let's say, this push towards, let's kill them all.
As the Nazis developed their plan to kill all Jews, on the 12th of August, SS Reichsfuhrer Heinrich Himmler met Friedrich Jeckeln. 2 weeks later, Jeckeln flew from his base in Berdichev to the town of Kamienets-Podolski, which had already been taken by the Germans' Hungarian allies. Here, 23,600 Jews, a combination of locals and those who had been expelled from Hungary in the preceding weeks, were now at the mercy of Jeckeln and his men.
Vadim Altskan, United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. The photograph of the men and women walking through the town.
These people were devastated, malnourished, and in horrible physical and moral state. They had to take with them members of their family, including those who were not able to walk anymore. So they're carrying old men, and it could be a relative, it could be a neighbor, it could be somebody's father. I mean, they're going to a murder site, massacre site, and this is their final hours, minutes of their lives. People were taken to this area. They were immediately surrounded by several circles, you know, of German security police and Ukrainian, so there is no way you can escape. Craters created by explosion were used as a mass grave. There was a wooden or metal plank which was put across these craters, and small groups of Jews were forced to undress first, then march in small groups, usually families, holding each other's hands, standing on this plank and shot. Not everyone was killed immediately. There were people who were just wounded. And so even when massacre stopped, for several hours, you know, Germans were going around and trying to finish those who were still wounded. As soon as the massacre was over, local people were mobilized to cover up. And for many, what happened was they witnessed, stayed with them for many, many years, maybe the rest of their lives. Because many people who they would be covering with soil were still alive. They could see them breathing, waving hands, trying to get out, and everyone describes a kind of movement of earth back and forth, like people were still breathing. It's very graphic, but nevertheless, a very emotional description of what happened in this place.
Gliding over the town with countryside on the horizon.
Kamenets Podolsky massacre, it was the first massacre of this size, which when we talk about not few hundred, not few thousand, but more than 20,000 victims in 3 days, 2 days of killing. All this would repeat itself again and again. It all started in Kamenets Podolsky, and this is why I think this massacre is a turning point.
The fact that the killing squads were now targeting all Jews, without exception, was to become brutally clear on the 21st of August 1941 in the Ukrainian town of Bila Serkva, occupied by SS men, commanded by Paul Blobel, and home to over 90 Jewish children whose parents had just been shot.
You have, in the case of Blobel, someone who was ready to pull up his sleeves and do just about anything. And he was present at the very controversial incident at Bila Serkva, this town about 90 miles west of Kiev, where those Jewish orphans, their parents had been killed first, and the kids were left, about 90 of them.
The German occupying forces are then confronted with a self-created problem. All of these orphan children, no one to care for them. Their approach to this is then to find a radical solution. And the German military commander in the town actually says, well, we need to get rid of what he terms scum. He uses this word.
Alex J.K., University of Potsdam. A forest with sunshine filtering through the leafy canopy.
They decide between them to murder all of these orphan children. And there are actually some protests by two military chaplains, one Protestant, one Catholic. And it's the only instance we know of for the whole of the Holocaust where military chaplains actually protest, actively protest against the murder of Jews.
The lush green woodland.
But to no avail, the shooting goes ahead and, you know, the parents of these children had been killed a few days earlier and then the children are all murdered as well.
Ian Rich.
The thought that ordinary people can be made to do such extraordinary things is a frightening one. It's little comfort, I think, that these were extraordinary situations that they were placed in. Someone has to create these situations. So this machinery of destruction, individuals have to work this machinery, they have to switch it on. A lot of effort and a lot of individual decisions were made about life and death.
Ukraine, Holocaust Ground Zero.
Just 8 weeks after the massacre at Bila Serkva, the people of a Ukrainian village further east were to experience the Nazis taking a new approach to their work, of shooting children alongside their mothers.
Well, this photograph is from October 13th, 1941, taken in Mariupol, Ukraine, about 100 miles west of Kiev.
what we're seeing here is this Jewish family is being murdered.
A boy's at the edge of a pit in the woods.
And we see German uniformed officials with local auxiliaries with these armbands. We can even see on the ground down below here, there's bullet casings. These are not the only victims. In fact, the smoke is hovering there. The woman holding the hands of a little boy and another child falling off of her lap. This is part of the practice of having the women die with the children, that they would console the children when they were brought up to that shooting site. The children were afraid. I came across this one Vasilyuk family, which was a mixed Ukrainian Jewish family. And on the page of testimony that was submitted by a survivor, she described in her testimony that her aunt was shot in the Mirapol Park with two children. And it was just striking to me that this woman could, you know, be the same figure, and that this little boy could be this little boy. But when I showed this picture to the woman, she couldn't make an identification. She couldn't say for certain. I felt like that was the extent of what I could accomplish there, forcing me to think about these realities of missing, of the limits of what we can learn. Doesn't mean we should stop digging.
Wendy Lauer comparing the family photo with the one of the murder in the woods. Archive film of troops and tanks.
While the mass killings continued to spread from town to town, from village to village, by late summer 1941, the Germans were already moving closer to one of their key targets, Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine and home to one of Europe's largest Jewish populations, including four-year-old Bella Chernovitz and her family.
I was born in 1937 in the city of Kyiv. My father was in the army, and he found out that the Germans killed Jews. He left his post, came home, and told my mother, "You have to go. Doesn't matter, don't look at anything." And they found out that there is one train, the last train, that wasn't actually a train, it was a cattle car.
Archive film of aircraft.
German plane with the automatic guns shot the population, shot through the train, through the roof, through the people. When the plane left, our train gave a short toot-toot and started to move. So it was a slow moving. It took a couple months. We went to Caucasus, but they caught up with us and we had to go further east. My mother fought tooth and nail to save her children. And many, many women didn't bring their children back. So many were lost in this war. A lot of people. God keep them in paradise.
Barricades and field guns.
While Bella fled with her mother and younger brother, by mid-September, the Germans had seized control of Kyiv and put in place their plans for those Jews that remained in the city. Plans that would result in one of the Holocaust's most horrific massacres.
The military leaders organized this campaign against the Jews of Kyiv and plastered these posters all over the city, calling for the Jews to gather at certain locations in the city. They brought them to this large ravine. Babi Yar means Baba, Babi, like grandmother, and Yar means ravine.
People were guided into the killing pit, and there they were awaited by a small group of professional killers. The killers stepped by their victims and shot them one by one in the neck.
The ravine.
In just 2 days, the 29th and 30th of September, the Nazis and their collaborators murdered over 33,700 Jews at Babin Yar. Such was the scale of killing here and elsewhere in the Soviet Union, Friedrich Jaeckeln developed his own system to maximize the capacity of the mass graves.
Jaeckeln began to develop some of these techniques. It's known as sardine packing. The Jews were essentially forced to lie down on top of each other several layers deep and were shot from very close range, mostly in the back of the neck. They literally had experts who would calculate how big a mass grave had to be, and they had other people counting the Jews as they arrived up towards the shooting sites. One witness at Babin Yar who said his job was to count the number of children, and he got to over 1,000 on the first day.
Martin C. Dean, author and historian. Portrait photos of children. Film of the steep-sided ravine.
I met one boy who was in Babi Yar, and he told his story. They were all there, with all his family, and they were shot, and his mother fell on him. And he was alive, laying under the pile of dead people until it became night. He crawled out from a pile of dead people, and he was the only one who was alive because his mother covered him up.
Photographs taken by Johannes Halle, a member of the Wehrmacht's propaganda unit, captured scenes at Babin Yar just days after the massacre, as Soviet prisoners of war were forced to cover up the bodies and Germans searched the clothing and belongings of their Jewish victims.
Two soldiers bent over in the process of searching.
2 weeks later, on October the 16th, Halle went to another killing site at the town of Lubny, 120 miles east of Kyiv. But this time, he took his photographs just before the massacre of 4,500 men, women, and children.
These are a very powerful set of photos because he takes close-ups of these Jews minutes and hours before they are going to be murdered. The faces are, few of them are blank, some are despair, some are anger, innocence in the children.
Ray Brandon, author and historian, he selected one of the photos.
This is a terrible collective act of violence against a people, and it is aimed at tracking down and eliminating every last one of them.
Ray's looking at the photo of the people. Another photo with naked bodies on the ground.
There's something very modern in the thinking and even the implementation of these mass shootings. Think about all the different institutions that it takes. For instance, there's a very famous photograph. It shows a Jewish man kneeling at the edge of a pit, looking kind of towards the camera, towards the photographer in this case. First of all, you see a solitary figure of a victim, of a man who's got the look of terror in his face. So that's very compelling and very disturbing. But the men who are standing behind him, and you look at the uniforms and you look at the faces and you see a real crosscut of the agencies and the types of individuals who, you know, could be at that place in that moment. You see someone who's a member of the Hitler Youth. You see someone who's part of the marching band. You see regular German soldiers kind of off duty, looking a little disheveled. The man who's shooting him, who's a member of one of Himmler's elite squads, right? And they're all there watching, you know, they're all spectators. And it's being photographed, right? It's being photographed at close range and openly.
They're on the right side of history, and they're going to take a picture of this to document victory.
The man in the photograph, wearing a look of fear, while in front of him is the pit with the clothed bodies of the recently executed. Archive film.
By late 1941, the Nazis were also expanding their range of victims, which included Soviet prisoners of war. So much so that in December, Reich Minister Alfred Rosenberg reported to Hitler that 2,500 of them were dying in Ukrainian camps every day.
A mass of soldiers being led along a trail.
The Germans didn't really treat the Soviet POWs on the same level as they would treat, for example, French POWs. They definitely perceived them as a subhuman category. Historians actually perceive what happened to Soviet POWs as a genocide of its own. There are approximately 3.3 million Soviet POWs were dead by the end of the Second World War.
As an attempted explanation, we can go back to this idea of zone of exception. The rules in the East are not the same. This is a colonial area. This is imperial territory. The people who are dying or who are being killed are of lesser value.
Janine's sitting in her garden.
As people deemed of lesser value, the Nazis' murder of 9-year-old Janine Weber's father in 1941 was followed by the death of her mother from typhus in the squalid Lviv ghetto. But although Janine and her younger brother managed to escape from the ghetto, their suffering was not yet at an end.
My uncle knew quite a lot of Polish Catholic farmers, and he found a family to hide my brother and me. The daughter of the family, who was about 20, came one morning with, he looked to me like a German soldier, and I knew she brought him to kill my brother and to kill me, because by then I knew they were killing all the Jews.
A photo of Janine as a girl.
For some reason which I cannot explain, he didn't want to kill me. And they killed my brother. They buried him alive. He was 7.
Her brother holding his mother's hand.
I was frightened for years, and I didn't want to tell people I was Jewish. I thought they would hurt me, they would kill me.
Ukraine, Holocaust Ground Zero.
By late summer 1943, the Nazi dream of an empire in the East was turning into a nightmare, and the Germans and their allies had begun their long retreat back across Ukraine and all the way back to Berlin. And as the Soviets advanced, they soon uncovered evidence of Nazi atrocities.
The Soviets start to examine killing sites, to dig up corpses, and so they collect a huge amount of evidence and material.
Soldiers filing in.
The Soviets also moved quickly to establish war crimes trials. The first Germans to stand in the dock did so in the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv, alongside a local collaborator, in December 1943, 18 months before the end of the war and 2 years before the Nuremberg war crimes trials. They were charged with crimes against Soviet citizens. The court made no mention of Jewish victims.
The quality of the Soviet trials is a big problem. The Soviet Union was a Stalinist dictatorship at that time, and the legal system was of the same quality. However, we know of the individual trials where we have evidence in the West against these people. So in most of the cases, I think these trials are reliable.
One of the soldiers on trial says, "I cannot recall all the cases, but I remember the case in Derhachi, where about 20 prisoners were shot."
One main difference to the Nuremberg trials is, at the Nuremberg trials, you had the very leadership as far as they survived the war and didn't took their lives themselves, like Himmler, for example. But in the Soviet Union, they have put to trial whoever they could find in this early phase. So you have people from different ranks.
Another soldier says, "The people were taken from the vans and then made to stand in smaller groups by the pits and shot down by SS men with submachine guns."
On the 18th of December, after a four-day trial, the defendants were found guilty. The next day, they were brought to a square in Kharkiv for their sentences to be carried out.
The men hanging from gallows in front of a large crowd in the square.
More trials were to follow after the war. In January 1946, 12 Germans were hanged following a trial in Kyiv, while in the Latvian capital of Riga, Friedrich Jeckeln, who oversaw the massacres at Kamenets-Podolsky and Babyn Yar, was found responsible for the deaths of over 100,000 people in the Soviet Baltic republics and also taken to the gallows.
In another court.
Just over 18 months later, in September 1947, 24 Einsatzgruppen leaders were put on trial in an American military court in Nuremberg, charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity. They included Paul Blobel, who helped orchestrate the Babyn Yar massacre, and Otto Ollendorf, whose units killed over 90,000 people, mostly Jews, in southern Ukraine and the Caucasus.
"Will you explain to the tribunal why you believe that the type of execution ordered by you was preferable to the shooting in the neck procedure adopted by the other Einsatzgruppen?"
Ollendorf says, "On the one hand, the aim was that the individual leaders and men should be able to carry out the execution in a military manner. Acting on orders, and should not have to make a decision of their own. And it seemed unbearable to me that individual leaders and men should have to kill a large number of people on their own initiative."
Einzelne Führer und Männer in eigenem Entschluss eine große Zahl von Tötungen vorzunehmen.
After a six-month trial, 14 of the defendants were sentenced to death. But only four of those sentences were carried out. Among those who were hanged on the 7th of June 1951 were Paul Blobel and Otto Ollendorf.
Their trial photographs.
Mass shootings, gas vans, starvation and disease. The Nazis, and those who assisted them, used many methods to kill their victims in Ukraine and elsewhere in the Soviet Union. This was the gruesome path that led towards the gas chambers of Belzec, Sobibor, Treblinka, and Auschwitz. A path strewn with the bodies of the innocent.
The photo of the boy on the edge of the pit and gun smoke in the air. The people being made to leave their homes on the way to the mass execution site. They're carrying an elderly man with them, a child wrapped in a blanket gazing forlornly.
Well over half of all Soviet Jews who were murdered by the German forces, it's about 2.6 million in total, well over half of those are Ukrainians. You have to address Holocaust in Ukraine if you're looking at, you know, the genocide of Europe's Jews. You can't get around that. It's really a center of Jewish suffering.
A woman kneeling on the ground and a soldier with his gun aimed at the back of her head.
We often talk about the lessons, but it seems like as humans, we are very bad in learning lessons. And Ukrainian history has many violent pages. Holocaust is one of them, and it's actually very close. And I just hope that there's going to be a time where we can discuss these issues openly, where we can remember them.
The photo of Janine with her mother and her brother.
I can't understand why to kill a child especially. Can you understand how it's possible? How can one do this? It still gives me a lot of pain to think about it and to talk about it.